This is a new voice for a new Scotland.
This is part one of a two-part panel discussion run by All Under One Banner. Part two will be broadcast next week.
Welcome, friends, to an online talk hosted by All Under One Banner. My name is Andrew. I help to organise All Under One Banner, and I'll be your chair for this evening. Now that everyone is here, we continue to miss the massive indie family, and we look forward to being with you, every single one of you, as soon as it's possible. You're all in our minds. Please continue to take the very best care of yourselves and of your clans, especially as the lockdown begins to evolve and the rules change day by day. I'd like to make a couple of introductory comments before we get started. All Under One Banner is all about organising marches on the streets of towns and cities across Scotland in support of Scottish independence. A few weeks ago, we announced plans for a gradual return to those streets, but with a few major differences. We are not organising any marches at the moment, but of course, when it is the proper time to do so, then you can be sure that we will immediately. Please bear in mind also that in the near future, there will be a Stirling Live online ceilidh on Broadcasting Scotland on Saturday, the 12th of September. We also have plans for more discussions and talks online, and I'll say more about those at the end of this evening. When we were beginning to plan this series of talks and discussions, we very quickly realised that panel discussions were particularly successful. We started working on a panel to discuss alternative routes to independence, and I am delighted to say that three great campaigners have each agreed to join us here this evening. Firstly, Suzanne Blackley is from Dumfries and is a campaigner for Scottish independence online and on her twice-weekly internet radio show on Webcom Radio. When she's not doing that, she has a family of three to keep her busy, and if that wasn't enough, she's about to start studying for her PGDE in primary education. Secondly, we have David Carvalho, who is originally from Finland. However, David has lived and campaigned in Barcelona for more than 20 years. He is the coordinator of Omnium Cultural's Shared Struggles project and has been campaigning against the far right, for example, in Spain against Vox. He has campaigned in countries as widespread as Uruguay and Egypt, and he writes just as widely, most recently with his book about the Russian Revolution. Good evening, David.
Good evening, and thanks for inviting me.
Thirdly, we have Chris McElhaney. Chris is an SNP councillor on Inverclyde Council. He led that council for many years. However, he has recently stepped down and is seeking the party's nomination to stand for Greenock and Inverclyde in the 2021 Scottish elections. Chris is a very keen supporter of Morton FC, and he says that his worst subject at school was Spanish. Mio Dio, Chris. It's great to see all of you here and thank you for joining us this evening. Chris, I was going to start off with you this evening. You worked with Angus McNeill MP to promote what has been called a Plan B approach.
Yes.
It would bypass a second referendum in the event that there was a majority in support of independence at Holyrood after the 2021 Scottish elections. To start this evening's discussion off, can you maybe say a little about what the thinking is behind that Plan B approach?
Yeah, sure. But yeah, Plan B, I suppose this is my fault, Angus's fault. There's a misunderstanding that Plan B means that you don't support Plan A. If that's the case, we would be calling on a new Plan A. So we're fully supportive of the best way to test the public opinion on whether the people of Scotland believe there should be, whether they believe that Scotland should be an independent country or not, is through a referendum. And ideally, because when Scotland becomes an independent country, England's going to be a substantial country that we share a border with. So you want to have a good ongoing relationship with that country. So ideally, the 2012 Edinburgh Agreement set out the best practice for how you have a consensual referendum process. But it's a consented consensual referendum process. But for the to be that same process, you need the UK government to agree to it. So if they don't agree to a Section 30 order and to have a referendum in line with what we had in 2014, thanks to the Edinburgh Agreement, then you quite simply cannot have that referendum process. So Plan B, I think, is the ultimate political tool to actually build the foundations to force Boris Johnson into a position that he agrees to a Section 30 order to have a referendum. But if he doesn't agree to that we actually start to build up a democratic legitimacy behind the very notion that the people of Scotland never lost their sovereignty. They may have gave their independence away in 1707, but we never lost our sovereignty. So if a democratic event such as an election expresses clearly the will of the Scottish people, then I think that is legitimate. And I think it actually then gets us into a campaign strategy and also sets out a tactic for, one, how we can continue to build on the momentum for the why Scotland should be an independent country, which is many well-rehearsed arguments, particularly since 2014, when the opposing arguments, whether it's on currency, whether it's on the EU, etc., are all crumbling on a regular basis. But I think what we need to be doing clearly getting into the 2021 election, because it's very easy to get a front page headline that says an SNP majority in 2021 means we will commit to holding a referendum in the life of the next parliament. But that's what we committed to in 2016. I mean, it was pretty clear, it's been well rehearsed, you know, in the event of that material change, something like Scotland being dragged out of the EU against our will, which has now happened, the people of Scotland would have a right to have a referendum on their own future. Theresa May simply didn't respond to the request in 2017. Boris Johnson and his surrogates that he sends north of the border, one after the other, talked down the notion of a referendum, and Boris Johnson finally said no himself. And just to pursue on this point for a moment, I think it's brilliant when I see polls that say that independence is now the continued majority view of the people of Scotland. I think that's absolutely great. And I think that from an SNP politician's point of view, with the SNP clearly being the major political party of the independence movement, that's great if that translates into votes for the SNP to get us elected again in 2021. But the SNP plan A, whatever you want to call it, isn't to win elections for the SNP, it's to deliver independence for Scotland. That's the very reason the Scottish National Party came into being. So I think that if we have another election, we're going to have another election in 2021, and if we're saying that clearly a vote for the SNP means we will have a referendum, and if opinion polls are currently sitting somewhere between 52% to 54%, with the European Union sort of leeway period coming to an end at the end of this year, the potential of a hard Brexit, if we went to that election, the SNP won an overwhelming landslide in that election, and Boris Johnson sitting in some dark room in 10 Downing Street with Dominic Cummings, and he's saying to him, well, Dominic, the pesky Scots, you know, they've got a point here. They voted a majority of SNP government, a majority of the seats, a majority of the votes. Support for independence is sitting at 60%, 65%. I think we need to give them this Section 30 order. Well, does Boris Johnson and the UK government want to keep the Scottish oil, the Scottish assets, Scotland in the UK? Well, I think the answer is yes to that, because that's why they've tried so hard to stop us getting independence. Why then would they sanction an independence referendum if we're thinking from their position for a moment? Why would they possibly, in this whole argument about democracy, we know that people like Dominic Cummings and Boris Johnson don't care about people's democratic views. I mean, you just need to look at him driving up to Barnard Castle and the fact that we're willing to throw the entire view of the Tory party in England under a bus to save Dominic Cummings. So let's not pretend for a minute that Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings are going to care about an absolute minority of the vote, which to them is Scotland. But I just think it's a really unrealistic prospect to expect that the more likely it is for Scotland to vote for independence, the more likely it will be that Boris Johnson will facilitate that by agreeing to a referendum on Scottish independence. So I think that leading up to the 2021 election, we've got to be clear that a vote for the SNP, a majority of pro-independence MSPs elected to the Scottish Parliament, means there will be a referendum on Scottish independence. And I would go as far as, in advance of that election, naming broadly a date of September 2021 of when we'll be holding that referendum. And that means that in that election, you'll be going to affirm that you are saying with your vote, you support a referendum on Scottish independence in September of 2021. And I think then that's a clear, democratic, legitimate choice for the Scottish people. So after that election, of course, if Boris Johnson wants to say, well, no, I'm not agreeing to a Section 30 order, then we've clearly got an electoral mandate that just says we're having a referendum. So where I slightly disagree with, and I must say I think it's a phenomenal effort for Martin Keating, the amount of money he's raised, it absolutely shows you the support and strength of the independence movement. Phenomenal effort. But where I disagree is that, for me, I don't feel that it should be the role of the Scottish Parliament to assert in a court of law that we are sovereign. I believe we are sovereign. If Boris Johnson and the UK government wishes to come and say that the people of Scotland, through their sovereign, democratic, elected parliament, don't have the right to ask the people of Scotland about one of the most fundamental issues of our time, then I think it's up to them to come and chase us through a court. So whether that they chose to do that or not, then that's what they should do. But if ultimately Boris Johnson refuses a Section 30 order, if he then manages some legal trickery to block the people of Scotland having a democratic choice on their own future, that's why I think we need that firm plan B there in this election manifesto that clearly makes it known to people in Scotland when they go to vote for SNP, and also makes it known in the decision halls of Whitehall and Westminster, that the people of Scotland say they want a referendum because they support the SNP or any other pro-independence party. I'll not try and monopolise that. They support independence, they support Scotland's right to choose their own future. But if Boris Johnson and the UK government deny us the very right to have a choice on our future, then we need a democratic mechanism to actually ensure Scotland's right to choose its future is enacted. And I think that that pro-independence majority of MSPs says that we're giving you the triple lock, Boris. One, we'll play it your way, the Section 30, in line with the Edinburgh Agreement. If you don't want to do that, well, the people of Scotland have agreed that we should have a referendum anyway. And if you manage to stymie that through court, and I wouldn't bet on his chances based on his last exercise when he came up against Joanna Cherry. But if he somehow manages to block us having a choice on our own future, the people of Scotland have already taken that very realistic possibility into mind when they voted in that election, and they've actually then said to the Scottish government, because we live in a representative democracy, remember, we kind of forget that with the burrack that Brexit cost. And if our democratic elected MSPs, elected by a pro-independence majority of seats and a pro-independence majority of votes, if they then vote in our parliament after Boris Johnson refusing us a Section 30 order, after Boris Johnson blocking us to have a right to have a choice in our own future, I think it's absolutely democratic, it's absolutely legitimate for our MSPs to then vote to enter into independence negotiations with the UK government. And at that point, I think we have moved the whole debate on a much greater distance than it is at the moment, and quite simply, to stop the people of Scotland having a choice on their own future, we've conceded that at the moment, all Boris Johnson has got to do is say no. I don't think that's acceptable, and that's why I think we need a plan B for independence.
Thanks, Chris. You made some fantastic points, and I think amongst other things, the multifaceted aspect of the campaign more broadly, using all legal and legitimate techniques and routes that would be available to us, including testing the question, as you say, the question that shouldn't really have to be tested, but anyway, testing the question of who is sovereign in Scotland, and of course, I suppose there's an English perspective there with the sovereignty of Westminster in English law and politics having been asserted, relatively strongly recently. The contrast with the Scottish constitutional position, I think, probably is one of the reasons behind it. But that was a great opening. Thank you. There's a couple of questions that have come up already, and if I may, I'll just deal with them quickly just now. Firstly, Jackie, who's in the room, is just asking, talking about the 2021 election and still building support, Chris, do you think it's now impossible to have a referendum this year? And there's a second question I'll put to you as well at the same time. It was a question with regard to why the SNP have pulled out of the Martin's court case. I'll not ask you to answer that. I'll give an observation about it. There's no point. I'm not going to put you on a position of giving legal advice in respect to the party. That's not the point. But to go back to Jackie's question, and I think it's a straightforward one, but in terms of this 2021 election and still building support, do you think it's now impossible to have a referendum this year?
Short answer is no. Nothing should ever really be considered as impossible in politics. Politics is often forgotten as the art of the possible. But I think pragmatically and logistically speaking, I come from Inverclyde. Still seeing every day some cases of the virus. We're still seeing an issue I was dealing with tonight, a traffic jam at a testing centre because people from other parts of the Glasgow region are coming here to get tested. That is, for many people, the priority right now, quite rightly so. So realistically, if we're talking about a referendum, we are having some serious teething problems and getting schools back to full-time education, businesses back to full-time. I think it would be very difficult under those circumstances to be then saying to people that we should go straight into an independence referendum sometime. Well, next month, September, so that's really out the window. October's out the window. November's out the window. Possibly you could do it in December if you managed to railroad through the legislation. I don't think it's pragmatic. And I think we should never lose sight that as much as when I'm going on about Plan B, a lot of people think it's the how. We've fundamentally got to make the case for why Scotland should be independent, because, you know, 50% plus one vote's enough to win the election, but I want the referendum. I want to win the case for Scottish independence on 60, 65, 70% of the vote. And I think that on the back of the sheer mess that Boris Johnson and the UK government are currently getting themselves involved in, and I think as it crystallises into people actually making a decision on actually when the Scottish government have the levers at their disposal, whether it's on furlough, which is ending in October. I think all of these things lead into a position that I think that people who maybe have had some family members have been unwell or have been died, I think it's going to take some time to recover from that. And as we go into next spring, into the summer, into a period of renewal, I think that's the ideal time to actually be, because you can't go knock a door, as we know, in this climate. And I think that the Scottish independence is a fundamentally important issue. But as great as these Zoom conversations are, you know, there's a large section of citizens still don't have the capacity to navigate stuff like Zoom, etc., social media, you name it. So I think that, yes, technically it would be possible, but I think that pragmatically and logistically it wouldn't be the right thing to do. And I think that's why we now need to affirm our not seek another mandate in 2021, because we've got several mandates that, you know, we need to start taking tally marks of how many mandates that people of Scotland have given the SNP and the Scottish Government. And I think in 2021, we should be affirming that, yes, there should be a referendum on Scottish independence. And at some point, at the end of the summer, start of autumn next year, that's when that referendum should be held.
Great, thank you. David, I'll come to you in a moment. But first of all, to give perhaps two different ends of the or two different aspects of the arguments from a Scottish perspective just now, and then we'll broaden it out, having covered the Scottish component. I was going to ask Suzanne. Suzanne, you campaign mainly online, and online campaigning for many, as Chris's points out, not for everybody, but for many people, online campaigning has online activities have become even more important during lockdown. Have you seen what's your view? What have you seen people in the who are working with you and campaigning with you online saying about the alternative routes, and in particular, for example, the Plan B that Chris has been talking about?
There's been support for Chris and Angus's Plan B. Absolutely, there's a lot of frustration with the people that I speak to every day on Twitter and on Facebook. As Chris said, how many mandates do we need to give the SNP before they do something? That's ultimately the question. And then also the fact that, you know, they wonder why we're asking for a Section 30 in the first place. That's a big question that comes up, because, I mean, how many prime ministers are going to refuse to give Nicola Sturgeon a Section 30. Honestly, in my own opinion, I don't ever see, if we just arranged a referendum, I honestly do not think that Westminster would take us to court, because then you've got to bring in the whole subject of the UN. And, you know, they're basically denying our right to self-determination. And obviously the stance that Westminster took on Kosovo, then you've got all that coming in. I honestly just feel that it's like we're setting a bar. But I keep asking for a Section 30. It's like we're saying to Westminster, right, we have got to ask you for this. Whereas, you know, I think that we could probably go it by ourselves. I honestly don't think that we have to ask for a Section 30. And, that, you know, that's why I've been supporting Martin Keating's case, because that just rules that out completely. And there's a lot of support for it on Twitter. A lot of people are right behind them 100% on this. And they're frustrated at people who are current SNP MPs. I won't name any names.
No.
But a certain one who seems to be blocking everybody and who has basically just ripped this whole Martin Keating's case to shreds.
Okay, there was one other thing in there that you were talking about, and it really followed on a little bit, a point that you made, and it follows on a little bit from Chris. From when you're engaging with, in your online activism and engaging with people online, do you get any sense that people are either want to know or understand the legal aspects, the constitutional aspects, they have a view on the political aspects? Do you feel that there's enough in the way of education and understanding to move the conversation forward, or do you think we would benefit from an appropriate period of concerted education and concerted discussion around about the nuts and bolts of the current constitutional position, subject of course to ongoing court actions as well?
I mean, ultimately, there's a lot of people on Twitter that know a lot. Probably more than some of the SNP officials. But yeah, I think that people would benefit from, you know, some education on it. Definitely. I mean, there's a few camps within the independence movement. There's ones who are just following Nicola Sturgeon because she's done such a good job during COVID. There's a lot like that. There's a lot who would just declare UDI tomorrow. And then there's another group who are just looking for different ideas as to what way we go next. And there's a lot of discussion on that.
Yes, yes. Yes, that's absolutely right. Thank you. That's great. Now, having spoken about two perspectives, or two complementary perspectives on the debate from a purely Scottish perspective, I'd like to turn now to David, who has experience of campaigning in a number of countries, but in particular in Spain. And of course, the legal aspects and the application of Spanish criminal codes to those who were campaigning for Catalan independence is well reported, including Catalan politicians who ended up in Scotland. So it would be interesting, David, to get from you a perspective of the both of the conversation we've had so far, which is broadly working within the constitution in the United Kingdom, unwritten though it is, but also other roots and other aspects that occur to you in listening to this conversation.
Yeah, well, as I said before, thanks for inviting me. It's a strange situation, really, because I was in Scotland just before the referendum and talked to people there, but I haven't been able to follow it in any detail. Every national question is different in some ways, but there are also some things in common. I mean, one comparison doesn't help you very much, but I mean, sad to say, because I grew up in Britain, but I'm sorry to say the British government is actually better on this than the Spanish government. If we look at the Irish peace process, there was an Irish peace process. Here, ETA tries to dissolve and tries to have a peace process, and the government said, no, carry on putting bombs. We don't want a peace process. And the ETA prisoners are still in prison, sometimes, you know, dying in prison. Yes. And in Scotland, at least the first referendum, they let you have it. And here, you know, the last time we tried to vote, we had 10,000 pleas smashing 1,000 heads. So in that sense, it's possible to talk about reasonable discussions and agreements in Britain that here are impossible. But I think some of the same arguments I heard here, I hear echoes of them in Scotland. Like a typical argument here was that if we have the referendum, like the last referendum, the 1st of October 2017, that was a unilateral referendum because the Spanish government didn't allow it. And people saying, if we get a big result, then they'll just have to pay attention. They'll just have to listen to us because that's democracy. And of course, it didn't happen. Then people saying, well, at least the European Union will have to intervene because it's human rights. You know, how can they possibly allow police repression against a citizens' movement in a European country? Well, I'm sorry, but I mean, European countries have been sending in riot police to attack citizens' protests for as long as it exists, and specifically national movements. And in other contexts, I mean, we've had 30,000 people die in the Mediterranean, and there's no sign the European Union's worried about that. We had European Union committing austericide against the Greek people, and they didn't worry about that. So there's no reason to believe that European leaders were going to lose any sleep about the democratic rights of the Catalan people, and they didn't. And so the parties that put a lot of faith in that then didn't know what to do. So I think, I don't know who, somebody probably said that in politics, in the end of the day, it comes down to power. Probably somebody horrible said it. But sadly, it is about that. Abstract democratic principles in themselves don't win, generally. The question is power. And so here then the question of what power? And even having the demonstrations, I mean, we've had the biggest demonstrations I've been on in my life, and I was on the anti-war demonstration in 2003, about 1.5 million people in Barcelona, is the biggest ever. The pro-demonstration, pro-independence demonstration has been even bigger than that. But, you know, they pay no attention. And so here, and picking up from what Chris said, that I think it's not enough to have 51% in the vote. Formally, it should be correct. I mean, in a democratic world, you say, you know, we have the referendum, we vote, and the majority wins. But we don't live in that democratic situation. So we need to find ways of expressing more force. I think that one of the best things for me that happened in October 2017, around the time of the referendum, was firstly, the fact that we had the referendum was only thanks to popular mobilization. I think the Catalan government called the referendum thinking it would be banned, and then they'd be able to complain to Europe saying, look, they wouldn't have that referendum. And it was popular mobilization, people occupying the voting stations all through the weekend to enable the voting to go ahead, resisting police attacks. That was the first one. And then on the 3rd of October, we had a massive general strike across Catalonia. And when you have a general strike, and it was a real general strike, it wasn't just a symbolic thing. It was, you know, people walking out of the workplaces and mass protests. One image, and I'll close with this. The working class area just north of Barcelona, which is heavily Spanish speaking, it's not independentist heartlands. Here, Catalonia is different from Scotland. I know in Scotland, it was a working class area that most voted for independence. In Catalonia, it's not at all. But it was the working class areas of the north of Barcelona on the day, the 3rd of October, the day of the general strike. There's a brilliant photo, this massive, massive avenue just full of people marching down into the center from that mainly Spanish-speaking working class area. And I think it's that the sort of force that can change the balance. It won't be a new referendum that would just be like another sort of a groundhog day of what we had before, and people have had enough of that. I think if we can put force on the ground, which isn't just citizens protesting, if it's workers stopping work, then that actually hits where it hurts, because it's actually the big ruling class in Catalonia is against independence. You know, they're not part of our gang, they're the enemy. And so if you could link independence much more strongly to the social question and to working class issues, then I think that's the direction I have to go to win. I interviewed Jordi Cuixart a few weeks ago, and one of the things he said, which is very impressive, he said, if independence was just about changing a flag, I wouldn't be in prison for it. We want the Catalan Republic because of our commitment to democratic and social justice. We can't conceive the national struggle without the social struggle, because they're two sides of the same coin. So I think we need to look at that side of it. Independence, not just to pull down one flag and pull up another one. There's a good quote by James Connolly about this, but to say we want a different sort of society. And I think along that route is where we pick up a lot more people than the ones that, you know, the 50% or so we have in Catalonia that want, you know, prefer Catalonia to Spain. There's a lot more people that would opt for a real social change linked to a constituent process around independence. I think we need to go down that line. For me, that's the sort of direction. It's not a simple answer in terms of having a referendum, having a vote in parliament. But I think the experience here is, unless we go down that way, we don't have any other route, because they don't pay attention to democratic votes. So we need something else.
Thanks, Stephen. That's a number of really important points in there. And I can immediately see, read across from some of the points that you're making to the current social circumstances that we're in Scotland at the moment, and other countries are too. The point I'm making is that, of course, we have so much government time understandably being committed to the management of the COVID crisis. And certainly from my conversations that I've had with international press, they seem convinced that the polling in Scotland that is improving in favour of independence is as a result of the performance of the Scottish government, in contrast to the Westminster government. Now, I've disagreed with every journalist that said that to me. I feel personally it's much more to do with Brexit, but that's just my opinion. But my point is that if the current performance of the Scottish government can be portrayed as having increased focus on social justice, literally the welfare of the citizens, and being more concerned about the welfare of the citizens than a Westminster government might be, and I don't think that's a very hard argument to win, it might be the case that, for example, the point that you're making about putting social issues and social justice at the core of the argument for independence, I think it is part of the argument anyway, but in the current circumstances where people's lives have been at risk, and you know, there's been a threat that wasn't around in 2014, to be specific, that maybe perhaps the social justice aspects to that are important. But also, and I'll stop talking because I'm not meant to be talking tonight. The point that you made about mobilization and organization of everybody is obviously extremely important and is something that's very close to our hearts and all under one banner. Mobilising demonstrations across the whole country is what we are here to do, and it's what's most important for us. So it's interesting to hear you talking about that being an important component part of the mixture of the toolkit that we use, of the variety of tools that we use to apply pressure and to secure the independence. Chris, picking up, you're in Inverclyde, as you said, one of the hotspots of COVID. We're not here to talk about COVID, but David's point about social justice, I think, is very important. What do you see that there's mileage in terms of tying the independence campaign to social justice for all citizens in Scotland?
Yeah, it's obviously, it's quite multifaceted. Personally speaking, it's a bit of a difficult one for me because I obviously, if you remember, won a legal ruling that had a philosophical belief in Scottish independence because I just believe that Scotland is a sovereign nation and it should be free to make its own decisions. And as much as my own personal political worldview is, I would probably relate to somebody like James Connolly that says that independence for independence sake, just to mimic and repeat the very institutions from the country you're seeking to gain independence from is academic. But it's always going to be a case of a democratically elected government of an independent Scotland did want to pursue similar policies in particular areas, and that's the whole point of independence, is a choice, whereas at the moment we don't have a choice. So people like myself often say that when Scotland becomes independent, we can rid Scotland of Trident. Now, I think that fundamentally, you would see overwhelming support from whatever government of any colour was elected to an independent Scottish Parliament. That, of course, is a choice for that government to make. At the moment, we don't have the choice. And again, back to the issue, which I think is related to social justice, is furlough. So communities like this and other parts of Scotland, I don't think it matters the nature of deprivation, to be honest with you. If you're on furlough at the moment and that scheme ends, I think there's going to be real hardship. There's an artificial employment figure at the moment because people are being kept in work just because of furlough. And as soon as that ends, I think many people that are in work are actually going to find that they're very quickly unemployed. But Germany, of course, have made a decision to extend that by, it's going to last 2 years, the scheme. In April, the Republic of Ireland's government, they raised €6 billion by issuing bonds to immediately invest money in various social economic policies to support people through recovery. Well, not quite recovery, actually. It was a sharp end at that point. But that was something like €18 billion oversubscribed, that scheme. Whereas in Scotland, we've only got the ability to borrow £450 million a year, which, I mean, I'm saying only because, you know, that's numbers we'll never, it's just big numbers. As soon as you get 100 million, because it's kind of beyond your grasp of how many cars and houses that could possibly buy you. But the point is, at the moment, you contrast this to independent Ireland. They managed in one bond issue to raise €6 billion, almost double what Scotland's actually allowed to borrow forever at any one point in time. So I just think it shows you why, if you want to have an agenda for social justice, something that's very important to me, I think that's why it's important to actually not just, of course, you've got to deliver the day job, because we've heard that one, get on with the day job. But I think we need to go beyond that sometimes and not be skipped. I think, particularly with the coronavirus, there's been an apprehension to get political, but it's a political choice to end the furlough scheme. It's a political choice whether taxes will be increased or policies such as the rape clause, a policy that was absolutely driven through austerity to save costs. All of these fundamental economic decisions are going to be made in the next 2 months, you know what I mean? How do we deal with the OBR's projection of 10% unemployment? How do we deal with the deficit and the debt, which are two separate things, of course, both important, what they currently sit on. And you should watch the network news, because it's quite important how they present this. Talk about approaching £2 trillion of debt. But they just gloss over the fact that about £600 billion of that's actually the Bank of England's debt, and the UK government is effectively the owner of the Bank of England. So it's just an example of how sometimes they present austerity as being essential and inevitable because of economic circumstances. We're in the trap tonight. We're speaking about, oh, we've not seen this level of debt since the war. Now, we're sitting at just over 100% of GDP, whereas at the end of the Second War, we were at 150% GDP. And in those very tough, I mean, much tougher economic circumstances, Britain, which is the Britain I think a lot of people are actually starting to realise doesn't exist anymore, that Britain created the NHS on the back of course, a war, of course, the economic turbulence that war caused. And you had a whole generation of people that actually in 2014, when I was knocking doors, they actually were quite agnostic to the notion of Scottish independence. But when they were thinking about Britain, they were thinking about the Britain of their childhood, you know, the post-war ethos, the NHS, things that, quite frankly, Boris Johnson, Dominic Cummings are actually probably sitting right now figuring out a way how to sell it off to the highest bidder. You know, I mean, chlorinated chicken sounds good. You know, it's a bit of a, it's a good way to capture a policy. But the reality is these are just distractions. It's the NHS is the real meal that's on the table. And I think that as more people realise actually that, quite ironically, in fact, of the sort of social justice agenda that got promoted after the Second World War was the reason you voted no in 2014, to protect that now, it might actually be that you need to vote for Scotland to become an independent country so that we can make sure we control our NHS. Because, of course, another tactic that's often used is, well, the NHS is devolved, so any decisions at the NHS is purely up to the Scottish government. But the reality is, if the UK government continue their clear privatisation agenda, and they continue to then reduce spending on devolved matters, that sees a reduction in Barmouth consequentials. And it forces us into having to then cut services or privatise services. And it's actually then when you maybe start to realise the fundamental importance of the wider economic levers, that when you don't have them in control, you're effectively just administrating a fixed budget across a fixed set of services, because all these big decisions actually determine how much your budget can be and what you can do. I mean, Kate Forbes, for example, if she copied what Ireland had done, which, you know, borrowing's at record low levels, it's at negative interest, effectively. You can borrow for free, as stupid as that sounds. Mm-hmm. And that's what countries like Ireland are doing. You know, that's like countries like New Zealand are doing. They're spending more per GDP than the United Kingdom. The Chancellor copied these furlough scheme from Norway. You know, it's all these small independent countries have managed to make these very important economic decisions. One, because it's easier to borrow than it's ever been before. Two, because they don't actually treat borrowing the way it's treated in this country. I mean, we think of borrowing like credit cards and mortgages, but these countries see it as, well, actually, I'm a shareholder in UK PLC. So when we talk about the furlough scheme, the government's bailing people out, actually, it's our collective endeavours, our common good going forward over the next 30 years that's helping people right now that are in quite a difficult position. So I guess that's quite a long-winded way to say there's two perspectives to it. One, Scotland should be independent because we should have the very right to make our own choices. But of course, two, there is a sizeable amount of the population that in 2014 where, yes, Scotland should be an independent country, but actually for me, not right now. And those people obviously then need more information on specific policies, which is where you can get into a bit of trouble, but also an opportunity, because that's why I think the more independence parties sometimes the better, because, you know, what the SNP say on independence could be different on pro-Labour independence supporters, the Greens, potential list parties, and I think that then makes it easier for people to understand that. So a vote for independence isn't actually a vote for the SNP, as much as it's important that the SNP won elections, because of the sheer size and power of the party has actually been the driving force in the campaign over the last several decades.
Yes, of course. No, that's some great points there. Certainly, in the comparison with their experience in Ireland, the 6.5 million billion euros that the Irish government raised is in sharp contrast to the 3.5 that the Westminster government say they're going to spend on COVID. So, a country the size of Ireland, smaller than Scotland, prepared to raise and spend double the amount of money that, that Westminster is on COVID relief and COVID-related projects, is, I think, is very telling. Now, a quick question for you, and I'm going to put this question to everybody, but John asks, and it's as a result of me starting this question, but John, who's in the room, says, can each of you summarise what you mean by social justice? Now, that's a very broad question, so I'm going to ask you to summarise what you mean by social justice in 2 minutes, if that's even possible.
Just any one of us?
I know, Chris, you go first.
Oh, I mean, for me, it's quite simple. It's the common endeavours, the common wealth of man and woman being spent for the betterment of society. Whereas at the moment, we live in a capitalist system that obviously you just think of anyone at the moment works with an employer. Well, where does the fruit of all that labour go? It often goes to shareholders. It often goes to owners. It often goes to totally disproportionate salaries with bosses on something like 15 times the lowest paid worker. These are socially unjust situations. And I think that a fairer, more equal Scotland that actually puts social justice at the heart of it, it should be looking at policies in such as, well, why do we talk about a minimum wage when the argument should be on a maximum wage? You know, it's obscene that, you know, you've got chief executives and bosses on seven figure salaries and workplaces telling people how, oh, you know, you need to take a pay cut, you need to go into furlough on 80% of your wages. It's obscene. And I think in a socially just country, of course, you would be absolutely driving a living wage. You would be driving policies that actually, the more money you spend putting into people's pockets, you actually then start achieving all these outcomes that we spend so much money at the moment through crisis intervention. Like, how do we tackle the drugs problem? How do we tackle obesity and diabetes and ill health and poor health inequalities, people's cost of living, life expectancy? I've got a life expectancy 7 years less than somebody 15 miles up the road in Mulgay. You tackle all of these issues fundamentally through a fairer society, and then people that are actually at the top of the tree at the moment actually realise, you know, by lifting people up, everybody's lives are a lot better than actually try to keep that unnatural man-made gap in society. And I suppose for me, in 2 minutes, I think on the button, that's what social justice is.
Fantastic, thank you. That was a full 2 minutes, but that was just perfect. Thank you. I think what I'll do is I'll go to Suzanne next, and we'll ask. It's important to get your perspective too, Suzanne. And it's the same question from your perspective. What in your lived experience and from your online campaigning, what do you think social justice means to you and to the people that you deal with?
I think it's equal opportunities. Ultimately, it's, you know, a more evenly spread distribution of wealth, people having more say politically and socially. I mean, really, ultimately, the Scottish government in Scotland is, you know, they speak for Scotland more than the Westminster government, just based on how many seats we have and, you know, the proportion of the vote. In Scotland, we vote for the Scottish government. That is all we vote for. In Westminster, it's a very, very small share compared to what we do in the Scottish government. So, I mean, really, for me, it's social justice is about equal opportunities for everybody.
Of course, no, that's fantastic. Thank you, and is exactly the point. That's great, David. Now, you started this social justice conversation, and I know it's, you campaign for social justice and on social justice issues across the world. So I'm not going to say 2 minutes, but it would be very interesting in the context, also some of the comments I'm seeing that I'll come to in a minute, but it would be very interesting from your perspective when you talk about it. What do you mean by social justice?
There's I have some friends in Ireland that are part of a movement called People Before Profit. And I think the term People Before Profit is actually the same term being used by health workers in Britain at the moment, in England at least. It's saying, what if they can suddenly find tens of billions of pounds and euros and dollars to say banks and companies, but there was never enough money for healthcare, education, jobs, let alone solving the climate crisis, responding to the problems of, I don't know, women that suffer gender violence, or migrants who are dying in the Mediterranean. And so for me, in brief, social justice would mean turning around all those priorities and saying, if there's a queue, well, the bankers have to be right at the back and the ordinary people have to be right at the front. But then that raises the question of who's going to do that? And I can't see any Westminster government wanting to do that. But I mean, Chris was talking about Ireland. I mean, my view of Ireland is actually very different. I mean, I was there a year or two ago. There's almost no welfare state. A friend of ours broke her ankle and she said, don't call an ambulance. It costs 600 euros. And so there's a whole series of things. So you have a low tax economy because they don't have any decent welfare state. And now there's now being social advances, thanks to the mobilization. I mean, the loan that Chris was talking about, I think it's about half of the money that the Irish government went to court not to collect from Apple. So they gave Apple computers a tax break of 14 billion euros and they went to court in Europe not to have to receive that money. So to then get a loan for some billions of euros, well, great, but they could have had 14 billion euros that was owed to them. And so you have a government, it's exactly what James Connolly said. They became independent formally, but ended up actually for decades, I mean, having a horribly corrupt system, which now, thankfully, now people are starting to change. I mean, in Catalonia, it's a bit better, but even here, the Catalan government for 20 years was under Jordi Pujol, who's now under massive corruption charges. Catalonia is a part of the Spanish state with the highest level of privatization in health and education of any part of the Spanish state. Now, with the COVID crisis, they said that we're going to use private healthcare services. Fine, but they didn't expropriate them. They're paying every single penny for those healthcare services. Actually, the health, private healthcare, the friends of some of the bosses of Convergencia, the Catalan right-wing party, some of them are now raking money in. And so because of the popular pressure, Convergencia shifted around to independence, but people can still remember that if there's a shortage of public health care and public education, it's partly because of that party. So I think if we're saying we want social justice, that can't be part of the same sentence as defending the record of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, well, mix them up because they're the same, the two ruling parties in Ireland or the ruling parties in Catalonia. We have to be clear that we're about something different. Otherwise, people just think this is a trick. I mean, every political force that comes up promises everything. But if you're actually defending the people that produce the current situation, then people see through it very quickly. So I think we do need to break with the current politics. And so I think that does mean it has the class question. It's about who goes first, working people or the rich and the business people. And you can't mix that up. I think you have to take a position on that.
Thank you. That's fantastic. And all that you're saying there is resonating very strongly with a lot of the comments that I'm seeing. Facebook, we had Heather Meldrum saying the government's only listened to big business and that is our area of leverage. Identify two or three of the biggest companies and campaign to ban their products or services as soon as it begins to hit in the pockets of shareholders. They will be pressurized by the government. Westminster will be pressurized by those companies to cooperate. The corporate world is our leverage, she says. And those points are coming up across. And certainly people are agreeing with you that, and from my conversations too, there is nothing to distinguish in many ways between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael in Ireland. And that is, and so that kind of small c, large c conservative approach is absolutely right.
This is the end of part one of this broadcast. Part two will be at the same time next week.
This is a new voice for a new Scotland.
And in life, dot radio.